Justin Hall is a prisoner in Texas. If the state has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison staff is preparing to put Hall to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage of the killing in Texas, the state responsible for half the executions in the U.S. Execution Watch host Marlo Blue, criminal defense attorneys Larry Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Huntsville reporter outside the death house Linda Huhan. The Execution Watch for Justin Hall begins.
Good evening, and welcome to the Wednesday, November 6th edition of Execution Watch. Whether you are listening live on one of our FM channels, 90.1 FM Houston, 89.7 Huntsville, or simulcast and archived at kpft.org, thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Marlo Blue. If you are tuning in for Arab Voices with your host, Saeed, heard here every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., well, check back next week, please. He will be on HD2 channel, found on the kpft.org website, where you can also find other listings that we have here on 90.1 FM. Please check back next week. Hopefully, Saeed will resume its regularly scheduled slot. Now, tonight, we stand in vigil as the state of Texas plans to execute Justin Grant Hall for the death by strangulation of Melanie Bilharts in El Paso County, Texas, on October the 28th, 2002. Joining us in the studio to put this case in perspective is our panel of experts, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie. Before we get started tonight, I'd like to respond to some of the feedback that we've been receiving on social media. To our listeners abroad, we hear you and understand that you appreciate the videos of interviews posted on our website. Our producer, Elizabeth Stein, has reached out to every prisoner on Texas's death row requesting an interview to be broadcast during this program and archived on our website for years. This is their choice. Elizabeth arranged for an interview with Justin Hall in October to be recorded by our associates at Houston Media Source. It is with great sadness that I report that after accepting our invitation, Mr. Hall declined to appear when we arrived. Again, please understand, this is their choice. You know, this program is the first and only live electronic vigil providing first-hand reports of the Texas death machine in action. We appreciate those of you joining us internationally on the World Wide Web, and we join those of you who stand in vigil on the streets of Texas cities and in front of the death house in Huntsville. Earlier today, Justin Hall was transported from the Polanski unit in Livingston, Texas, to the death house in Huntsville. Our reporter, Linda Huhan Snyder, joins us now live by phone from outside the death house in Huntsville. Linda, describe the scene for us, please.
It's dark out here, but they've just now gone into the chamber. All the witness, his mother is a witness, and his sister. And the pastors, they've already crossed the line.
So we were expecting for the mother and one of the sisters, but we were also, I believe, we heard that there was another sister who might be joining the protest outside. Did she make it?
She's not here. No, she's. I don't know why, because she told me today at visit that she would be here with us, but she has not shown up.
What is the atmosphere like there tonight, besides dark?
We're all sad, but, you know, he wanted to go. I mean, I talked with his mother in length today, and his mother said that he did not want to live his life in prison. So he did not want anybody to fight for him because he didn't want to even go to GP, you know, get a life sentence. He just said that he was tired and he's worn out and he's ready to go.
So you did get a chance to get that information with him?
From his mother, yes.
How many people are there with you tonight?
There's about 10 of us out here.
And of course, even though this isn't something that Justin wants, we need to go ahead and ask if there was any word of a stay.
No, nothing has even been filed for him. His attorney stopped filing or doing anything because he asked them to.
Linda, thank you so much for your eyewitness account, and please call us when you hear of anything, please.
We certainly will. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Linda Hujan-Snyder, and we'll be standing by for her report. So now let's go to our panel for some insight. It seems that we come here way too often for these executions. But in this particular case, tell us how Justin Hall got here. Let's head over to you, Mike.
Justin Hall was 21 in 2002 when this happened. Justin Hall was a member of a so-called white supremacist group called the Aryan Circle. Aryan Circle is not the Aryan Brotherhood. It is a fraction of the Aryan Brotherhood. It is a Texas prison group of hundreds of members. He was a member of it. Their activities include many criminal activities, including methamphetamine production and sales. He ran a meth house, according to the record. He was the captain of the local Aryan Circle group. At this meth house, there was a pledge, a prospect, a young man wanted to become a member, who brought over his girlfriend. Something happened at the drug house. Something happened where she claimed that she was improperly touched, and she was upset, and she threatened to call the police. When she threatened to call the police, Mr. Hall felt like he had to do something.
Why was she calling the police?
Because somebody had touched her inappropriately at the drug house.
Okay.
Okay, and for that...
If I could just jump in just for a minute. It's my understanding that Ted Murgatroyd, the other person, and Melanie Billhart were actually girlfriend, boyfriend.
That's right.
And they were coming over to the house in Melanie's truck.
That's correct.
And Ted was driving, and they got into some sort of an argument, and Melanie supposedly went off on him. And so she's beating him and everything and makes him get out of the truck. In the process of her beating him, she ended up bursting her lip. So she gets out of the she makes him get out of the truck. She drives to the drug house. And when she gets to the drug house, she's still angry, and the guys there see that she's been bruised. So they go out to Ted Murgatroyd, and they're trying to get him straight, saying, you know, what did you do to this girl? And he's explaining to them, I didn't do anything. I mean, she's the one who did. And she's still angry because she flipped out, and she said, I'm going to call the police on you. And when she did that, it's reported that that's the point at which that Hall decided that, you know, if she calls the police, there's going to be a problem. And so he threatens to kill her.
Okay, now you keep saying drug house. Is this just a party house? Is there something else going on here?
I believe it, Mike. They deal meth out of the house.
It wasn't clear, but my interpretation, it wasn't a combination party house, sale house, maybe even a production house. Meth is normally made in people's bathrooms and in their homes. It's got to be made someplace. It doesn't say anything, but I had assumed it was where it was manufactured. And quite frankly, if there wasn't manufacturing going on, they wouldn't be afraid of the police because there'd be nothing there for the police to find. There had to be something there that made them afraid the police would find it. Drugs, they could get rid of. They can't get rid of equipment to manufacture or chemicals to manufacture. So based on that, I assumed it was a manufacturing plant, but I'm just guessing.
And this is in El Paso, Texas, so... And I'm not sure what kind of area, the rural area or suburban area or not, but the cases suggest that these people, several people, we're talking about four males and this young lady, and who else was there, I don't know, but the cases reflected that they used to hang out at the place and that there was the presence of drugs there. And so the case is just referred to as a drug house.
Okay, so let me get this straight. This prospect, Ted, and his girlfriend,
Melanie,
have a fight. And it's in front of the drug house or near or in the vicinity. And she gets upset because he whacks her around and abuses her.
The case just says she said something that he didn't like, and she jumped him.
Mm.
That's what the report says. She jumps him, and in the process of her attacking him, she gets injured and puts him out of her truck. And she drives the truck off, and he's got to walk.
Then how do we get to Justin Hall?
Well, Justin's there. He's apparently has some interest in. And when they get to the house, Justin is there, and Justin and the other guys, when Melanie gets there, they're ticked off at, you know, how did she get injured? And she is apparently suggesting that somehow that Ted Murgatroyd, her boyfriend, is the one who did that. So they're about to exert some discipline on him. Okay, so that's how Ted and the other guys get involved as to what are we going to do to him? How do we quash this thing? And then she starts talking about she's still angry and she wants to call the police. And everybody else says, well, let's just figure out what we're going to do. The cases suggest that that Hall is the only person who says anything about killing her. And then Hall and Melanie leave together in her truck. That's what the cases report. And then Hall then comes back with her body in the truck.
It also seems like Hall was the captain of that group.
But he was young. He was like 21,
but
right?
He was still the leader, the so-called captain of that group, of Aaron Circle. So it would be his responsibility to take care of these kind of things. His decisions to make on how to protect the people.
So, how was Melanie killed?
Well, the evidence seems to suggest that she was strangled with a power cord. And the power cord was reported it came from the drug house.
Yeah.
So she was strangled, and the report suggests that only Hall and Melanie's body comes back in the truck. Hall then tells Murgatroyd, we need to go and cut off the fingers so that there won't be any evidence of DNA under her fingernails, and dispose of the body. So they drive to New Mexico?
Mm-hmm. 30 miles.
This is from El Paso.
Yeah.
And they cut off the fingers, and Murgatroyd says, I thought that Hall kept the fingers. But the fingers had been cut off. Fingers on one hand. After the body was disposed of, and mind you, at the time that all of this occurs, Hall is on bond from having committed another murder.
He's on bond for having committed another murder?
He's on bond
it's
for...
It's okay now.
He's on bond for having committed murder, having shot Arlene Hector Diaz. Okay, a cross-dresser who lived as both male and female, and somehow the two of them hooked up. He would hang around the bars where he or she would hang out, and he ended up getting into some sort of an altercation with this person, Arlene Hector Diaz, and shot in the back of the head. And he'd been charged with that, and was on bond for that crime at the time that this incident occurred.
That would have to be a fairly large bond, yes?
When you say fairly large, I mean his record was, and I don't know what the bond was, but his record was not really that bad. He'd had a burglary and a theft or something in his background. So when you say a fairly large bond, if it's, you know, this is back in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. so, you know, it could have been, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, which would require somebody to put up, you know, pay some money and put up some collateral. But the fact is, he was on bond at the time, which makes you wonder, you know, what the bond system was doing and what the court was doing in order to keep up with him.
We got a case in Harris County now where a capital murder defendant facing the death penalty is on bond and commit another murder.
So
now this is after this bond revision situation. Yeah. Now this is back in the
but this is now.
This is a recent case we're talking about, not
this year.
Well, so, I mean, you mentioned sexuality involved in this.
In the prior case,
yes.
In the Arlene Hector Diaz matter.
Was the Arlene Hector Diaz case actually charged? Did he go to trial for any of this?
He was charged, but he didn't go to trial because this capital case occurred after that case, a few months after. Okay, and so once they sought the death penalty, I mean, this would certainly come up in punishment, but the Diaz case was not a capital case, so they couldn't get the death penalty for that. So once the case in involving Melanie Billhartz occurred, and the state elected to seek the death penalty. Now the Diaz case was a simple murder.
Mm-hmm.
Was it a hate crime?
It was referred to as a hate crime, but not a death eligible hate crime.
Why?
I'll just have to say I don't know. I just don't.
Yeah.
And we were talking about hate crime earlier, and calling something a hate crime in the legal system oftentimes doesn't do a whole lot. Other than make the people who are the victims of crime feel better. But it, from a defense standpoint, it actually increases the prosecutor's burden of proof. Because while you have to show intent or some other legal responsibility for all crimes, the prosecutor never has to prove motive. And hate crime sort of increases the prosecutor's burden of proof, in which it pushes them into the area of having to prove motive. But that case was already pending. Mm-hmm. He was out on bond for that case, and I would suspect that his being on bond for that case might have been a part of the motivation for the DA seeking the death penalty on this case, because there are certain requirements to seeking the death penalty, and one being retaliation for someone seeking to exert a legal right. And so what the DAs did in his case, and then there are other reasons for seeking the death penalty if you commit a murder of two or more people in the same incident. This wasn't that.
Mm-hmm.
Young children escaping from while you're in an instant escaping from a penal institution, other kinds of killing a police officer. These cases weren't in the same episode, same criminal episode. So the element that was chosen to make this a death case was retaliation, saying that Melanie Billhartz was going to go to the police and report Hall. So that was Hall's motivation for killing her, and that was in retaliation for her seeking a legal right. And so that made him then death eligible. And I talk all the time about how in all cases, but particularly it's tragic, I think, in death penalty cases, when the DA decides they want to kill somebody, they've got great amount of discretion in doing that. And so they didn't have to seek the death penalty. No, they never have to seek the death penalty in any case. But in this case, when you add up the fact that he's already out on bond on another murder, which is a hate crime, which is against a cross-dresser, that probably had a lot of people feeling real angry toward him.
Right.
And then so now it's like, let's see what does the law allow us to do to him. And when you look at the death penalty statute, retaliation allows them to do that.
The time is now 6:20. If you are tuning in expecting Arab voices, I'm sorry to disappoint you. Saeed will be back next week, we hope, although there is another scheduled execution. You are currently listening to Execution Watch. We are here in vigil, electronic vigil, as it were, as the state of Texas is executing Justin Grant Hall for the death of by strangulation of Melanie Bilhertz. I believe that's right. So what happens afterwards? How does Hall...
Before we go to that.
Mm-hmm.
Does the fact that electrical cord was taken from the drug house with him when he went to kill her show pre-intent versus act of emotion? And I mean, does the fact that he took her out with a plan with that cord to execute her have a bearing on this case? It wasn't just crime of passion.
And I didn't see anything on that. And
he brought the weapon with him.
I didn't see anything in the reports on that. And sudden passion doesn't even come up. And Jim used to talk about the fact that sudden passion, there's no place for sudden passion as a defense in a capital case. In other cases, it is, but not in a capital case. But to piggyback on something you said earlier, Marlo, about our schedule, okay? Mm-hmm. That is, we've got scheduled executions for the next 3 Wednesdays.
That's right.
Today, a week from today, and 2 weeks from today, whereas we had some scheduled before.
Yeah.
And they got stayed. But now we're on, this is number 8. And we've got a pretty active schedule for the next 3 weeks. And it seems as though we sort of tapered off some, but now we're really back full force on executions. This one, with the discretion the prosecutor has in terms of seeking the death penalty and getting it at least at the trial level, is something that they've got a lot of discretion to do that. A tremendous amount of discretion to seek the death penalty or not seek the death penalty if they choose not to do so.
Do you think if this was not a gang-related offense, it might not have been a death penalty case? If it was just a drug house and people doing drugs and somebody got murdered like that, how much was the Aryan Circle a factor in executing him?
That's a really important question, I think. I mean, was he defending their livelihood? Was he defending the gang of some sort?
And more than that, the concept of criminal acts, there's an argument that they were connected because he was protecting the drug house and killing her, and in killing a transsexual, one of the, I want to say aims, but one of the things that circles against is transsexual people. So there's an argument that was a crime of the gang against a transsexual, and that the defending of the drug house from the woman was a murder. So there was an argument. They were the same episodes. Larry, do you think so, or am I wrong?
Well, not part of the same episode.
That's
but
a long time in between, isn't it?
A few months.
A few months.
But it's got to be the same episode, and that would be that's more of a stretch, I think, than retaliation. But recognize that in most counties, this, whether we seek the death penalty or not, is decided by a committee within the DA's office. And you can rest assured that all of these things we're talking about right now, they all went to the pot. I would imagine that when DAs sit around and say, do we seek death in this case, those kinds of things all would have gone to the pot. And then if we seek death, how do we get there? And retaliation then falls out.
And again, if the Aryan Circle name was never brought up, if his tattoos were not brought up, if this was just a murder at a drug house between a bunch of people doing meth, would this be a capital crime? The more I think about it, you got to think that people in that part of town don't like these people. They think they're dangerous and criminals.
Well, a little more clarification on the Aryan Circle, because if the Aryan Circle, I know the Aryan Brotherhood is almost always associated with prisons as a prison gang. So are you saying that there are outside groups of the Aryan Circle
it
that
seems
are
like
pedestrians? Or?
Well, it seems like this was a splinter group and I do not know much about these groups, but it seems like this was a splinter group of the Brotherhood when some of the members thought the Brotherhood was turning to religion, turned to things that they didn't want to, they wanted to do more criminal activities, and the Brotherhood was getting away from that. And so they
organized crime group. Are they white supremacists?
I don't want to put a label like that on them. Everybody else does, but I can't say that. I can't say that.
Okay.
But they'll label that in the prison system with a bunch of other groups that are considered white supremacist groups.
But they consider themselves a crime family.
What I understand is that's one of the reasons they broke away from the Brotherhood, which is an older group, because they wanted to do more crimes. And it seems like that they've got like 600 or 700 members in TDC, mm-hmm. and they've been recruiting a lot more out of TDC in the civilian population, which is where they're starting to get more attention from local police. Well, I wonder how much of the being a part of this Aryan circle was a reason to make a point of this, rather than just, because part of me wonder, if people are in a drug house and there's an argument and fight and somebody gets killed, it's normally not a capital case. It's normally just a murder case.
You mean the person who's killed doesn't count?
No, it's a murder case. You normally don't see a capital case over people fighting in a drug house. It's a murder case. A capital case is a whole other level of case. And I wonder why this is a capital case.
It's because the prosecutors decided to make it a capital.
That's what I'm saying.
And they look at the penal code and determine that it all goes in the pot. And so here's a person who, my guess is, you know, if you are on bond for committing a hate crime, killing a transsexual person or a cross-dresser, and then you commit this offense, and it appears that you're doing it to keep from going to the police to find out about your illegal activity, then that makes their case. But you can imagine that all of these things had to go into the pot. Now, the whole thing about his being part of the Aryan Circle or the Aryan Brotherhood or these gangs and so forth, all of these things are so nebulous, and the police themselves determine who is and who's not. They just say he's a documented gang member. You see that all the time. You say, you know, what makes him one? Because a bunch of people hang out together and do crimes together, supposedly. Even people walking through can be. Now, this guy appeared to be one. Hmm. But all this goes in. But despite all that, even having gotten a death sentence, it appears that another issue in this case, while we're here tonight, is that Hall seems to be a volunteer, and to me that this case reads like a person who is achieving suicide by the state. He gave up. And not just gave up, he was an active participant in the effort to secure his death sentence.
Well, let's go there, because we had originally talked about the crime. He went to trial. He was found guilty. Then he went to prison.
Did he confess?
No. Oh, excuse me.
Well,
he did
yes.
give a confession. In fact, he gave a confession right away and was sentenced real quickly.
How was he tied to this crime?
Well, by everything Larry said, he left with the guy. He left with the girl
by
in the pickup truck and came back with the body, and there was the cord.
Okay.
Plus, he gave a confession.
Okay.
Now, later on, they claimed the confession was improper. Later on, they claimed that somebody else might have strangled him because they wanted DNA testing on the extension cord that was used to choke her. And this is what happened 15 years later. The lawyers are going through everything they can to save this guy's life. And meanwhile, he was 21 when it happened. He spent 15 years on death row. And like Larry said, it almost seemed like he gave up, because he went to court and filed his own motion to fire the lawyers. He said, I did it. I don't need no DNA test. I did both murders. These lawyers are just milking the case. I want it over with. They then decided that he was not competent to do that.
The lawyers representing him.
And he wasn't competent to do that.
Who he fired?
He tried to fire, and they wanted to get off the case because he was not competent to fire them. And okay. If you think about it, he wants to die. How is that competent when you want to die? It's inborn in human beings to be alive. There was many motions, many arguments before the court. There were psychologists brought in, and right after the court denied him the right to die, he tried to kill himself. Now, he tried to kill himself by ingesting methamphetamine in his system.
How did he get methamphetamines in prison?
From what I understand, and as we know in prior cases with the guard, it seemed like you can get anything you want in prison. Okay, but to overdose on methamphetamine in prison, you'd like to think it was so much methamphetamine that where did he get that much? We ain't talking about a little bit. He overdosed on methamphetamine, tried to kill himself with methamphetamine on death row.
So that was 2017?
That was 2017. Then after that, there was more psychological examinations. His mother got involved. There was counseling with his mother, counseling with professionals. And they all said he was just acting very bizarre, just standing there, gazing at people, not talking, acting very, very bizarre. You kind of wonder how much you want to die when you go to the appellate court and say, these lawyers are trying to keep me alive. I don't want to be alive. I did it. I want to die.
Now,
when they don't let him, he tries to kill himself.
It does seem that, at least at the trial level, he was putting forth the effort to not be found guilty. But the evidence was fairly convincing, and he gave a full confession. Now the lawyers tried to keep the confession out, but it came in. But he'd also confessed to other people, and Murgatroyd gave a lengthy statement as to what happened, because Murgatroyd was with him in terms of disposing of the body, and the confession contained things like the chopping off of the fingers that he told Murgatroyd to do, so that there won't be any DNA under her fingernails. That was something that was not known to the general public, but that was in his confession. So there was the standard complaining about the voluntariness of the confession, because they read him his rights and so forth. He said, well, I was impaired because I hadn't been asleep. I'd been awake for like 7 days straight. But when they found him in her truck, they found him asleep. And there were a lot of different things. But he was found guilty. He seemed to have been really struggling not to be found guilty. And he appears to have assisted his lawyers in that effort. But once he was found guilty, the system allows for a lot of appellate remedies. You automatically get an appeal to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Direct appeal, he loses there. Then you have all of the collateral remedies. You have your state habeas corpus proceeding, then your federal habeas corpus proceeding, then you're trying to get a certificate of appealability and going up to the Supreme Court. He loses all of those post-conviction remedies, but he fought his lawyers every step of the way, saying that I'm tired of this, I don't want to, because the only remedy would have been, if you don't get the death penalty, the only remedy would have been life in prison. And he made the conscious decision that I don't want life in prison. So this whole thing about having a state, a habeas effort, he says, Judge, I don't want that. And so his lawyers opposed him on that and said, Judge, you know, he's not even competent to waive that right. And so that was the issue of raising his competency. He testifies, it just says, sounds competent to me. So he is competent to waive the right. We've evaluated him, found him to be competent, and he can waive that right. So he waived the right for the state habeas, and he's doing the same thing with the federal habeas. But he's losing, and the lawyers are still filing things on his behalf over his objection, saying that the the jury selection was tainted, okay, raising all kinds of issues on his behalf, sometimes over his objection. And at that point, it's a matter of at every level of the of every criminal proceeding, I can't say this enough, that people charged with crimes, you know, ought to work with their lawyers, because the lawyer, no matter how good or bad the lawyer might be, they can do you a much better job than you can. Now, his objective was different than his lawyer's objective. Apparently, he was a volunteer.
Methamphetamines, hatchets, violence. You may be thinking that if you've just tuned in that you're listening to the plot of a made-for-TV movie, but you're not. You're listening to Execution Watch here on 90.1 FM in Houston, kpft.org. We are talking about the execution, which is going on as we speak, of Justin Grant Hall. So, do inmates have the same rights as other adults that are diagnosed with intellectual disability? And since their lawyers were saying that he has a low IQ, he can't represent himself, does that change the way his rights are at all, or was he just simply ignored?
In the law, we throw around a lot of different words that have a lot of different meanings. So the in terms of your mental capability, the fundamental concerns in the legal system is, first of all, whether you're sane, meaning you know what you're doing, and competent. Okay, so sanity and competency are threshold issues. If you're insane, you can't be held criminally responsible. If you're incompetent, then you cannot stand trial. Intellectual disability, in terms of death penalty cases, that would be fall in the area of mitigation, in terms of whether the person should receive the death penalty or not. Now in terms,
let's get back with that in just a moment, okay, if we may. The time again is 6:37. You are listening to KPFT, and I believe we have Linda Huhan Snyder on the line, reporting to us from outside of the death house. Linda.
Yes, hi, I'm here.
Thank you. Can you tell us what's going on there?
The witnesses just crossed the line, going back into the other unit, you know, not so the execution is over.
Were you able to speak with the mother or sister again?
No, not yet.
So at this point in time, they've gone in to see the body, is that?
No, they've gone. They'll get in their cars and go over to the church, but it takes them a little while to get the body there.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be the first time the mother will get to hug her son after all these years.
Linda, do you have anything else to report to us?
No, that's it. It's pretty quiet out here. No reporters tonight or anything.
It seems to be a very, very quiet day for this. So
yes.
Well, I do hope... We hope that there will be a postponement, but otherwise we'll speak with you next week for Patrick Murphy.
Okay, you'll be speaking to Joseph next week because I will be a witness for his execution.
Thank you so much, Linda. Thank you for all you do.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Linda Huhan-Diaz Snyder, and I just want you to know that part of the reason why we do this show is because there are so many people in the state of Texas, and we know worldwide as well, that are standing up for prisoners, are standing up for the right to life, standing up to end capital punishment. And we applaud those people. This is Pacifica. We are the network of peace. And I'm sad to report that the state of Texas has just added another murder to its slate with the additional death of Justin Grant Hall. As of November 5th, yesterday, there were 18 death row inmates that have been executed here in the United States in 2019, 17 of those by lethal injection and one by electrocution. Let's go back to our panel, please.
I'd like to say something about what Larry was talking about. It's interesting to me that the appellate court, when he tried to say, I want to die, I want everything to stop, the appellate court said that even though he hallucinates, he's paranoid, he's depressed, and he's bipolar, what do you expect? He's on death row. That's how you're supposed to be on death row.
What happens when you are in isolation for that long, knowing that at any moment you could be dead?
Which gets to what Larry said. Is that sometimes worse than death? To have those kind of mental disorders, to be locked in a cell without drugs, without alcohol, alone, and thinking about all these things, can that make you have hallucinations, paranoia, depression? I wonder if it is. So he wanted an end to that with his own death. And as Larry said, this sounds like a state-assisted suicide. He couldn't take it anymore, and he wanted to die. That's interesting. Which also gets to the other point, is it more punishment to lock a man in jail for his entire life or to put him out of his misery? I don't know the answer to these things.
You know, you always tell us to follow the money, and especially on capital cases. What's your analysis of that?
In this case?
Yes.
Okay, in this case, you got two interesting issues. Number one, according to the man, the lawyers were trying to just make money and stretch things out. But the problem with this, and the thing that I think Larry will agree with me, is sometimes death row inmates are like patients in a hospital. When they know a patient is going to die, doctors do risky things to learn more about medicine to try to save other people. The argument is that even though to him these lawyers were not doing their job, what these lawyers are trying to do is set a precedent for the next case that it can be helpful to somebody else. So in a sense, it's not about him. It's about the procedures, about the system. He is a pawn in the system, but he's an important system because of what he did. But this is not about him. It's about the next guy up and the next guy up and the guy out there who's in high school who hasn't even done this yet. How's he going to be treated when he gets arrested or something like this?
So, what's the verdict saying basically these days? Is capital punishment a deterrent to these types of crimes?
I've got a strong opinion about that, and I've had this opinion for a long time. If you have to justify capital punishment, it's got to be a chilling effect on society. When Johnny grabs a gun and Johnny robs a store, and the store owner shoots Johnny, the next day, Johnny screwed up. Johnny tried to rob that store and he got killed. It's a chilling effect on the community. That's the only purpose of capital punishment, to keep other people from doing it. But when you arrest them and you put them in jail and you kill them 20 years later, it's just cruel. And there's no, it's not his fault anymore. It's the lawyer's fault, it's the judge's fault, it's society's fault. It's always somebody else's fault. There's not a good purpose to deter other people from grabbing a gun. And all the best is saying, if you want to rob a store, rob it. Just don't take a gun with you. That's why, that's the excuse for execution. It happened immediately, and there's a chilling effect in the neighborhood because Johnny screwed up.
You know, Larry, you brought this up in several discussions ago, and I have to ask, is Texas in the business of executing people?
Right now, clearly, we are. I believe that's changing because society is changing, even in Texas. We're executing fewer people. And even in Justin Hall's case, I'm not sure what would have happened had he fought the execution. The prize would have been you get life in prison, and he didn't want that. But as Mike mentioned earlier, and we are a nation of laws, and Mike mentioned earlier, he was talking about the judge in the in one of the habeas proceedings, who talked about the condition. The lawyers were seeking to overturn the death sentence by claiming by filing a habeas action. And Hall didn't want them to file the action, and so they said, Judge, he's not even competent. Okay, he's not competent to do so. So we've got to make this decision on our own. Just as, you know, all this stuff that you're bringing up, you know, about the things that he's suffering from right now, that's normal. That doesn't mean he's not competent. And so what he's saying is, I don't want to proceed any further. Judge says, I don't see anything that suggests that he's not competent in making that decision, because he is. But we are clearly in the business of killing people. I think that's changing. I think just even some of the trends we've seen in looking for a reason to grant a stay. Some of the cases have really surprised me in Texas. Even since we started doing this show, mm-hmm. it seems as though there is a change in the way we look at the death penalty. Might not be real encouraging. It might not be happening real fast, but it's even in Harris County, we're not seeking the death penalty. Harris County has been for years. Texas, the death penalty state. Harris County is a death penalty county, and we're seeking fewer in Harris County than ever before, it appears to me.
There was a rather famous name that came up, of course, as we talk about the Court of Criminal Appeals, and that one of the judges was Sharon Keller. Some of us remember her as what we called the 5 p.m. judge for not listening to a last appeal on that. Did that have any bearing on the case, her notoriety?
Well, from the opinion I'm looking at here, she delivered the opinion of the court. Okay, so the writer tends to be, she's the lead on this.
Yeah.
Okay, but that's just in the appellate case. And when you look at the appellate decision, it's just a matter to see, have there been reversible grounds for reversal on appeal. So Keller wrote the decision delivered by in which Kiesler, Harvey, Richardson, Newell, Keel, Walker, and Slaughter joined in the opinion, and you already concurred. So there's not a whole lot of, I don't think this is something you can just say that Keller was the driving force. She was the lead, not the driving force on this decision, because it was a matter of, you know, you look at the arguments that are made for a reversible error, and there weren't a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
And that shows how counties are getting more and more specialized in how to handle death penalty cases. They're not making mistakes. They're appointing good lawyers, and they've got good lawyers on both sides. And if there's no reversible error, then there's not a whole lot that can be done about that.
Can only rich counties actually launch a death penalty case? Have we gotten to that point?
Paying for it—that becomes an issue that the citizens decide. There's some poor county that if a bad enough case happens in that county, they'll come up with the money to do it. Okay, so it's the changes that are occurring on the voter level, on the taxpayer level, and so we are in the business of, I guess the song was "Don't You Know They're Killing People." We're in the business of killing people because the taxpayers have decided that is a good use of our money. And once they decide it's not, then we'll stop doing it.
But they don't know what it really cost. They think it's cheap to execute somebody. They don't understand how much it costs them to do an execution.
The large counties like Harris County, the voters are not really that it. But the smaller counties, they know. And that's why so many of the smaller counties don't do it. But you let a heinous enough case occur in even the small counties, then the county has to decide, do we want to do this or not?
Which gets to a point I brought up before, and I want to mention it again. I think it's interesting that Philadelphia has changed the rules in criminal law where defense lawyers are allowed to argue the cost of incarceration, the actual money cost to the jury. What it's going to cost, not how many years he gets, what's it going to cost? Is that a proper thing to put in front of a jury on the question of life in prison or execution? If you give him life in prison, it's going to cost the taxpayer so much, but execution costs the taxpayer so much more? Is that not a relevant factor for juries to listen to when trying to decide if it's worth executing this person? What the cost of it is? Because we can agree that life in prison is cheaper than a capital crime.
But still, we're in Texas. We're not in Pennsylvania, and it's not the law in Texas. And
but should it be?
Should it be? Whatever it turns out to be, it's going to be based on what the citizens decide, and as through their elected representatives.
But the question becomes: should the citizens know the cost of the penitentiary when they give somebody 25 years in prison? They need to know that's $1 million. But if we give them 10 years in prison, it's only $500,000. Does that not become a relevant thing for juries to decide in punishing people? Because we tell them now 25 years, they all know what's going to be paroled out quicker than that. He's not going to do that much time, and so they can give heavy sentences. But if it's money, they might not give us heavy sentences.
And we've got lots of anti-death penalty groups who are reasonably well-funded, so I guess if one of them want to take that up to the legislature, they certainly can do that. But there are lots of efforts
underfoot right now. But the question is, should a jury hear it, not a legislator, not the appellate court, should the jury know the effect of their verdict that this is going to cost their taxpayers this many millions of dollars?
And my response is, they'll never hear it if it's not the law. And right now it's not the law in Texas, and the only way they can hear it is that we've got to change, the law needs to be changed.
That's a very interesting discussion.
Is there a law that says you can't do it, it's just we don't do it?
The only answer I got to that is, I don't know, but it would have deemed,
because nobody does it. We assume we can't.
It would be an irrelevant argument, I would think, because when you look at the appellate decisions, a lot of lawyers try to get a lot of things in, but it's left up to the judge to let that in, and I don't think that would be relevant. Not under current law.
What's more relevant than the punishment? What's more relevant than the punishment? We're going to punish him. How much do we want to spend to punish him? Do we want to spend $500,000 or $1 million or $10 million?
And I don't have a legal answer to it, Mike. I just don't.
Either do I.
Yeah, that's a little bit beyond our pay grade at this point in time, I have to say.
Maybe some of our listeners have an opinion about that.
But it is very specific that we do know that even the state of Texas admits that after they execute a prisoner, it's no longer considered an execution, it's considered a murder. Is that correct?
It's homicide, yeah.
It's called a homicide. A murder is an illegal killing. A homicide is just a taking of a life. It's a homicide, but not a murder. Hmm. So cause of death is listed as homicide.
And I was interested in the fact, or a little bit surprised, that one of the deaths that have happened, or one of the executions that have happened here in the U.S., here in 2019, one was done by electrocution. I know that we often talk about old Sparky and the room that old Sparky used to be in over in the death house, that now they hand out medication to the prisoners in that room, and that seems rather cruel, and as the case may be. If you want your medicine, you have to go into the room where old Sparky used to reside, or still does. It seems that there is no humanity in any of this. Why do we continue to endorse it?
Something Jim used to always say. We call ourselves a Christian society, but all we want is vengeance. Vengeance is not part of being a Christian. This is vengeance. It's people... Do people really want to punish people that do bad, or do people want to feel good that they don't do bad, so therefore a reaffirmation of my good life is you're being punished for being bad? If you're not being punished for being bad, how do I justify my sacrifice in being good? Does that make any sense?
But we are making progress. I mean, we are still a frontier kind of state, and there used to be a time you take the horse thief out and you string him up. We've got laws that say you can be death eligible only for these offenses, and so it's limited. It's more limited than it used to be in the past. We need to limit it some more.
Yeah, but correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't a lot of the mentality of execution in the old days, hanging a horse thief and just lynching somebody, was to get rid of their seed, to get rid of their offspring, to end the DNA, not end that person's life, end that whole string of family.
To wash out the line, the genetic code?
Wasn't that the reason they executed people? Now we're doing it for punishment.
I think it's been vengeance for a long time, Michael. That's just my opinion, but we're just about done here, aren't we?
We are just about done here, I must say. Of course, we have all gathered here, as we've been gathering so many, many times recently, and I apologize for that to everyone. We were here for the vigil, the electronic vigil of Justin Grant Hall, who was executed by the state of Texas tonight, this evening. And it is time to wrap up Execution Watch for today. Please join us again next Wednesday, November the 13th. We hope that there is a stay, but please watch out for us when Texas plans to usher Patrick Murphy into the death chamber in Huntsville. If it does, well, we'll be right here. Execution Watch will be here to cover the state-sanctioned killing live. We do welcome your opinions on social media and beyond. And to learn more about the death penalty and executions in the state of Texas, you can join us on Facebook at Execution Watch or online at executionwatch.org. We've got a mailing list right there if you're looking for any of the latest updates on everything that's going on. And please, please stop by kpft.org to show your support for this program and others and make your secure contribution to this station. That's kpft.org. Thank you to our panel, Larry B. Douglas and Mike Gillespie, Death House reporter Linda Huhan Snyder, executive producer Elizabeth Stein, and our engineer Don Freeman, for their assistance on today's program. Up next, People of Earth with Jean-Baptiste, and following that, of course, Flash Gordon Parks. On behalf of the Execution Watch crew, I'm Marlo Blue. Good night.